Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Corey.
Hey guys, how's it going? So good to be here.
And Dr. John Glasheen. Now we're going to have a chat today about trauma, as that is the question or the topic that has been sent in and is the most popular one. So John, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thanks, Alex and Corey. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I'm not Australian, as you can hear from my accent. I'm from Ireland. I started my pre-hospital career in, I hate to say this now, 1998 in the National Ambulance Service in Ireland. And it's sort of working my way up from EMT level, which is basic life support level, sort of through paramedic, and then ended up going back to do medicine in Ireland, and then came over to Australia in 2013 for a year to work at Sydney Hems and at CareFlight, as it was at the time. My wife is a critical care paramedic. She came with me, and we just both love Queensland so much that we have stayed, and you're now stuck with us. So I am an emergency physician. Currently, I've got a great job because I work part-time with QAS on the high acuity response unit and in the operation center, doing a new role that's just evolved in there. And I also work at LifeLight, doing air medical retrieval and doing some clinical lead duties up at the Rockhampton base.
Awesome. That's a pretty extensive background and clinical knowledge. That's amazing. So trauma is a bit of your bread and butter with being, you know, an emergency physician and background of paramedics. We'll start off with the basics, the start of it. How do you approach a trauma scene or developing sort of that systematic approach for that type of case presentation?
Yeah, look, I think you've already hit the two sort of nails in the head here in two of the phrases you've mentioned. Number one being basic and number two being systematic approach. And that's, I know this sounds ridiculous and people go like, oh God, here we go again. But that really is what it's all about. You know, you get to a point where as, you know, as a flight crew or as Harrow, you can add something that other people can't do. But ultimately, if the first things aren't done first, then all the other stuff is entirely pointless. It's almost analogous to, you know, you can intubate and give adrenaline and whatever drugs you want in cardiac arrest, but unless somebody is doing CPR, then the whole thing is pointless. And it's similar with trauma. So I definitely have a sort of a systematic approach. Excuse me, sorry, I'm not choked on my tea. So I try to use the 0-point survey. And, you know, when Cliff Reid and the others published this a couple of years ago, I was like, hang on, I've kind of been doing something like this. I hadn't been able to write it down or have the wherewithal to articulate it well. But I think we all do some form of 0-point survey. And it's definitely worth having a look at that, if you haven't come across it before. But I try to prepare myself mentally on the way to the job. And I don't know if any of you who have been to big trauma jobs, you know, obviously you get heightened and with experience, you get a little bit less heightened, but everyone gets heightened to some extent. I think some of us hide it better than others, but I think everyone gets heightened by these big important jobs all the time. So it's important that you prepare yourself mentally. And as a mental exercise, if you do a big job when you're in the truck with your team and you're dispatched, your MDT beeps and you get a bit of verbal information and you have some time to prepare yourself. If you compare your reaction to when you're just driving along in your own car or in an ambulance or whatever, and you just come around the corner and suddenly it's there. I know I behave and react differently to those two situations. Even if you just have like 30 seconds of warning that it's going to happen, you react completely differently. So I think your self-preparation is really important. Similarly, the preparation of your team, you know, because all of your team members have to go through exactly that same process as well. Hopefully your equipment will be already prepared. And look, I know with the pressures of work currently at the moment, you know, you don't get time after log on to check your truck, but you do need to check your truck and check your equipment, because the last thing you want to do is to find, oh, the truck isn't yesterday, you know, the pelvic binders are in this cupboard and another identical truck has the pelvic binders in a different cupboard because somebody has got some personal preference somewhere. But you don't want to be, you know, go to your truck to find a pelvic binder when you're already under pressure and then you can't bloody find it. So you do need to prepare your equipment and your primary, secondary survey, which we can talk about in a little bit. And then I think this is the next key thing. So the next part of the 0 point survey in the step up mnemonic is the U. And I think the U is the most important thing, because as soon as that MDT beeps and your information starts coming through and you get verbal information, whatever, and you have a chat amongst your team, you are building your mental picture for what you're going to see. Now, I can 100% guarantee you that if I'm sitting beside you in that truck, my mental picture is different to your mental picture, just because we're different people. And it's really important that if you're the clinical team leader, and also if you're not the clinical team leader and the clinical team leader doesn't do this, then you probably need to do it. You need to give people an update. You need to identify what's going on. So if you go, trying to pick an example from the air here, but let's say you're going to a motorcyclist who's come off at high speed and he's got a head injury. And so somebody does a primary and secondary survey and go like, yeah, motorcyclist, high speed, head injury, but they've also got a disrupted pelvis. The other person who hasn't done that survey may have been gone to the truck to get that pelvic binder or gone to get something. But unless people get an update and everyone's on the same page, then people stick with the mental picture they had when they arrived, and they don't necessarily have the current correct mental picture of what's going on. And that's, I think, when you run the risk of people going off on tangents and diverging in terms of what their treatment plan is going to be and what they think is going on. And that can be simply sort of put aside by essentially what is just a recap of what's going on. So it's an update for the team about this is the situation. It's not the situation necessarily that you expected or that you wanted, but this is the actual situation. And then the last part of the process is the plan. So this is the situation that we've actually got, and this is how we're going to deal with it. And this is what I want done in the next 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And it's important to remember that different people have different levels of clinical expertise, and everyone is doing jobs. So everyone misses out on bits and pieces here and there. So just as one example, after we RSI somebody, I normally take a little bit of a break. So the tube goes in, we confirm it's in place. So clinical confirmation and title on the monitor. And then there's a natural pause while we tie the tube in. So generally I'm holding the tube and somebody else is doing the tie. And I will generally take a couple of seconds out at that point in time to say to the team, it's like, right, we've got the tube in, patient's hemodynamically stable, unstable, whatever it is. And I will say, the next thing we're going to do is pop down our gastric tube and we will be ready to leave in 2 minutes. So that's a cue to whichever paramedic is driving the truck to like get in the driver's seat, turn the van on and get ready to go, because we don't want to waste time. You know, it's really easy to sort of fall into that trap of inertia where everyone looks at the cool procedure or whatever is going on and nobody is planning or getting ready for the next phase in care. And you know, you can make pre-hospital emergency care as simple or as complicated as you want, but one of the key aspects to it, regardless of how complicated you make it, is the transport. You know, I think we underestimate that sometimes because we get focused on interventions and procedures and drug doses and ultrasounds and all sorts of stuff. But ultimately, that patient needs to get to hospital. And we know that the longer we spend out there, the worse the outcome is. And, you know, if you watch TV shows, you know, the golden hour is the golden hour, whatever. And there's no evidence whatsoever for the golden hour. But the concept is very true and very valid that you want to get moving out of there as quickly as you can. And I think, sorry, I'm rambling, Alex, but here we go. This is what you signed up for. I think it's very, it's impossible essentially for us to switch on to rapid movement if we don't do it all the time. Now, I'm not suggesting you should go out for, you know, your 2As and somebody who's got, you know, unsteadiness or dizziness and vomiting, whatever, and like rush them out of their house, that's the wrong thing to do. But if you've got somebody where you've identified that this is potentially time critical, I don't think you can go like, oh, this is not really time critical, I'll just take my time today. Because tomorrow, when it is time critical, you won't be able to wrap up. You think you can, but unless you do things all the time and figure out where the snag points are for you and for your team, then you'll just fall down. So I think having that systematic approach in terms of the, you know, the 0-point survey, if you don't want to use that one particularly, just have some sort of systematic approach. And then the second part was that I mentioned about the basics that comes into your primary and secondary survey. So the basics are, it is your patient. Okay, and again, this seems like, what is this guy talking about? Of course it's my patient, but it's your patient and you're responsible for this patient. So your responsibility is to actually examine them. You know, clearly you've got to bear in mind their dignity and what's happened and what's going on and all that kind of stuff, but it's your patient. And if you don't examine them, two things will happen, which I will guarantee you. Number one, you will miss things for that patient. But number two, you won't build up a bank of experience for you to be able to go, hang on, that's not normal. You know, when you examine somebody in your 5,000th patient in 6 years time, you will go, hang on, that's not normal. But you cannot easily get that sort of pattern recognition unless you examine your patients. So that means not doing a cursory examination or a cursory, you know, put a hand on the abdomen in a couple of places. That means actually examining them with a clear plan of what you're examining for at that point in time. So there's no point in you being distracted by something else while you're putting hands on chest. So if I'm putting hands on a trauma patient's chest, I'm listing in my head the things that I'm expecting to find. And I'm probably only listing maybe 10 things. But anything else that's not one of those that I find, I have to kind of go, oh, hang on, where does that fit in the picture of things? But if I'm also thinking about where this patient's going to go, how much ketamine I'm going to give, why has that paramedic not putting the binder in the right place, then I'm not going to do a proper examination. So you've got to examine your patient and you've got to do it properly. And it's only over time, and by time I mean years, that you will figure out what's normal or what's normal for this type of patient in this type of situation. You know, I think oftentimes we're guilty of looking at stuff and not knowing how to contextualize it, and therefore we ignore it. And one example I'd give of this is, you know, somebody who's tachycardic. So you go to somebody, a call for, you know, a generally unwell, and they've got a heart rate. So it's a, let's say it's a 50-year-old lady who's got some, you know, vague abdominal pain, just doesn't quite feel right, but is eating, is drinking, is not vomiting, doesn't have diarrhea, doesn't have any major medical background. Something is going on. And it's very easy for us to go like, hang on, she looks okay. I'm not really concerned about anything major in her history in terms of, it doesn't look at this stage like sepsis, doesn't look like AAA, it doesn't look like renal colic or any, you know, the other things that run through your head. But she's got a tachycardia of 115. And it's so easy to just put that aside and go like, oh, it's just 115, you know, I don't really know what to do with that, so I'm just going to ignore it. And I think that's what we do cognitively. We sometimes ignore these things that are right there in front of us just because we don't have the ability to contextualize it. But after you've examined 5,000 patients, you kind of go, hang on, a heart rate of 115 in this otherwise normal lady is not right. You might not necessarily identify what's not right, but it's not right. And I think that then heightens your ability to search for other things, or your threshold to search for other things to try to contextualize that. But the key thing is that you can't ignore it. And you know, that goes back to the basics, because one of the basics is you get vital signs, you get heart rate, respiratory rate, all that stuff that you do. And I think it's so easy, particularly early in your career, that you can write this down in an essay, in an exam question, and you know exactly what to do and what to say. But sometimes when you get to a real situation, you either don't do it because you're, I guess, maybe a bit overwhelmed by what's going on, a bit unsure of what you should do next, a bit unsure of what's normal, and therefore you don't do it. And then you get a finding like that and you're not quite sure what it means. So you just go like, oh, I'm just going to put that aside for now. If there's something you're not sure of, ask somebody. Don't just sort of leave it there and go like, I'll come back to that later. This is important. And you know, the So the basics are examine your patient, get all the clothes off, and then you need to prioritize what's next. And it really does come down to that primary survey. Again, that sounds completely simple. And I think some of the questions that you sent through will probably come back to that point again and again as we chat. Does that make some sort of sense?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great perspective, I guess, on the systematic approach. And I love how you highlighted the importance of an efficient and effective transport. Just off the back of that, someone sent in a question and it says, I guess that there's no doubt that you've been to your fair share of heightened situations. What are some practical tips to remain cool, calm, and collected on scene? And I guess manage your emotions when seeing confronting injuries.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big topic. I guess experience is a key part of that. I think your innate personality, some people, like I said earlier, are better at hiding it than others, are better at pretending that they're not heightened. I think we all are. I think we get better at managing it as we get more and more experienced. But I think self-awareness is really important. I think you need to recognize in yourself when you're getting to that sort of heightened phase. If any of you have heard of Stephen Hearns, so Stephen Hearns is a retrieval physician based in Glasgow in Scotland, and he's just written a really good book. I'm struggling to remember the name for just now, but it'll come back to me. Performing under pressure is what it's called. Performing under pressure. And he describes a state of flow. So if you imagine your ability to perform is graphed against the stress that you're under. So some stress is really good because it makes you perform better. But that graph sort of tails off. So you get into a state of flow, which is where you're at your most high performing. And then if you add more stress to that situation, you get into basically a state of fluster and you can't. Your performance decreases from there. So I think it's really important to be self-aware enough that you recognize in yourself when you're going from that state of flow into fluster and that you can sort of pull yourself back from there. And then the strategies that I use to pull myself back from there generally revolve around reminding myself that this is not my emergency, managing somebody else's emergency, which is a bit selfish, but I think it's a useful sort of concept. And the other thing that I use practically to do it is to do a recap. So you take a little bit of time out because that stops your brain from processing unknown information and gets your brain back into processing known information and gets your team up to speed. And usually at the end of a recap, I'll go, is there anything I've forgotten? And then usually if there's an answer that I haven't seen or recognized or known, then usually one of my team just gives it to me. And it looks like I've been really clever and inclusive, but actually I'm just leaning on my team for their help. I think also that, you know, I don't think you can overstate this actually, but experience is key. If you've seen, you know, 20 mangled legs, for example, the 20th one isn't as impressive as the first one. So I think you just can't overstate the value of experience. And I think it's really worthwhile to try and get that experience in as many different places and formats as you can. And one strategy that you can use potentially. So we all spend so much time. Well, on Harrow, we don't, thankfully. It was one of the horrors that we're spared from. But most people spend a lot of time on the ramp in hospitals. So if you see something going on like a procedural sedation to reduce an ankle, if you just ask, you know, can I stand in the corner of the room and look, then you see that ankle in its dislocated or abnormal state. You see what's involved in the preparing for the reduction, the procedure itself, and you know, the sight, the sound, the smell sometimes, you know, it's a really good way of training yourself to what that's going to look like when you're the one actually doing it. So one of the things I used to do when I worked in ED in Ireland, and I'm not sure how ethical this is, but anyway, I used to get student paramedics who were on the ramp to come and help me with procedural sedations like that. And I would get, so if I was the one doing the sedation as opposed to the procedure, I would get the person to hold the airway. Okay, so you've got an awake patient, and I would get the student paramedic behind the bed, patient's usually sort of sitting up, maybe semi-recumbent. And I would say, I want you to pretend that you're in the backseat of a car. You're holding this person's airway. They've got a head injury. Their level of consciousness is going to decrease, which it is because we're about to give them propofol. And I want you to manage that airway. And they would almost invariably go, yeah, sure, I can do that. No problems. And then we get the propofol and fentanyl, whatever the mix is going to be for the reduction. And the person would reduce the level of consciousness, would generally require some airway support. And that paramedic would not be able to do the airway support because they got distracted looking at the leg. And then I would say, what are the SATs? And usually the answer would be the SATs are fine, but they didn't know what the SATs were. And then they look at the monitor and go like, oh, that's not right. And then they concentrate and do their part of the procedure properly. And SATs come back up and everyone's happy. So I think that's a really important lesson, that if you're doing a task in that kind of setting, then that is your task. If you're assigned to airway, then you don't worry about the leg. If you're assigned to the leg, you don't worry about the airway. You trust that your team member is going to do it. Because particularly when you haven't seen very many of these, your bandwidth can't possibly be as wide as you would like it to be. So I think being task focused is really useful, so long as somebody, as in the team leader, is not task focused. If you're the team leader, then you cannot be task focused. But otherwise, I guess to some extent, you should be.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense. And you bring up a really good point. In terms of when you're stressed, obviously your bandwidth gets shorter. And that's something that we've spoken about quite a lot on this podcast. As a student, Joel, that we spoke to recently, who's doing a research project in students undertaking a scenario, and they're watching their stress response using astro skins and things like that, and trying to utilize some mindfulness techniques to try and overcome a little bit of that stress response so that they can be task focused and do what they need to do without becoming overwhelmed with that stress. So I thought it was really interesting. And even a book at the moment that's just come out called The Resilient Shield by a doctor named Dr. Dan Pronk and his brother and their other friend, who were all in the special forces in the military. And they're talking about that sort of that graph that you mentioned in terms of stress, where it's kind of an upside down U. You get to the point where it's optimal, and then once it goes the other way, it becomes a hindrance really for whatever you need to do. But you brought up a really good point, and that being team and leadership. So what are some of the best ways to handle a scene as a leader or just in the team as or in general when you're approaching these types of scenes?
I think leadership goes hand in hand with followership. I think both elements are equally as important. If anyone has some spare time, Google or do a YouTube search rather for the shirtless dancer. I know you're nodding like you've probably seen this before, but the shirtless dancer just shows the importance of the first follower. So as a team leader, when I arrive, for example, with Haru or with Lifelight, I try to identify who the first follower is going to be. And the first follower is usually the person who's been team leader up to that point in time, because generally as Haru or as Lifelight, we arrive, and because we're going to be taking over care of the patient, we sort of de facto become team leader at that point in time. Which maybe isn't necessarily the best way, but that's just the way it sort of organically happens usually. So I think my tips as a team leader are to be inclusive but decisive. You don't want to come in too hot and heavy, if you like, at the start. If you think about how long it's taken you to get there, and this is particularly true of aeromedical stuff, and just to a greater extent with Haru as well. If you think about what's happened in the, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, maybe 60 minutes before you get there, is another 90 seconds going to change an outcome for this patient? Very occasionally, a patient is clearly tensioning in front of you, has clearly just lost an airway, then you might need to step in and just sort that out if the team haven't had the tools or whatever to do that before you get there. But generally, even in these very sick, unstable patients, take 90 seconds, introduce yourself, get a handover of what's going on, and then you go, thanks very much, that's awesome. This is what we need to do from now. So there's a clear sort of role delineation and role change, but you haven't marginalized the team immediately on your arrival. And I think, you know, keeping people sort of on your side and more importantly on the patient side, because you need these people, these people to help you manage this patient. And if you fracture the team early, it's so hard. And in fact, it's probably impossible to get that team back together. So I try my very hardest to sort of keep everyone on the same page and moving forward at that point in time. I think it's also important to be a follower. And to know when it is time for you to follow as opposed to lead. And sometimes that is very obvious in terms of, again, if you use the example, you know, the helicopter has arrived, the helicopter is going to take your patient away. You know, that's clearly, this is what's going to happen now. But you know, less clearly, if you're an ACP and let's say a CCP arrives to assess the patient, you're probably going to need to hand over leadership at that point in time while the CCP is assessing and deciding what's going to happen next. And then sometimes you will take over that leadership again. It might well be that the CCP drives the truck and you're as the ACP are now in the back of the truck and you're now again the clinical team leader, or it may well be that the CCP gets retasked to something else and you're again the clinical team leader. So that that leadership goes back and forth quite a bit, and you'll probably have seen this again with us within the Harrier team. It's generally, it's always a CCP, and sometimes there's a doctor there as well. And you'll often find that leadership role goes back and forth between the CCP and the doctor, depending on what's going on at the time. And I think within a small, you know, high functioning team like Haru, that leadership followership just happens organically. But I think particularly if you're dealing with a team that doesn't work together every day or all the time, I think there probably needs to be a little more of an explicit, hello, I am now the team leader. It doesn't have to be as obvious as that, but there has to be some sort of point, I guess, where leadership is handed over from one person to the other.
Yeah, those were some great points that you made about leadership. I actually read something the other day that said leadership without influence is counterproductive. And I think that you, I guess, perfectly summarized that in the way that you prioritize taking that 90 seconds before arriving just to maintain that positive team environment and not fracture it. Another question that got sent through is, what is the team in the resus bay actually listening for in a trauma handover? And what are some pertinent points that either get missed or don't really need to be said in that environment?
I guess the key thing that I'm looking for is a structure, and I don't particularly care what structure that is, but it's pretty easy to identify early on whether the person giving the handover has a structure or not. And look, it's completely fine to be nervous doing this. It's a big deal. But it's very obvious if you're just rambling. And if you're just rambling, I've got a very short attention span and I will switch off very quickly. However, if you've got a structure, it's clear that because you've got the structure, you will get to the point. I was just about to say you'll eventually get to the point, but if you've got a structure, you will get to the point of what you're trying to get across. And I try to remember the advice that I just gave a minute ago in terms of, you know, you've arrived at hospital. Is 90 seconds going to change anything for this patient? And the answer is, you know, almost certainly not, unless there's a clear intervention that's needed right now. If you look at, and I'm guessing, you know, the audience for this is predominantly going to be Queensland and predominantly Brisbane. And if you look at trauma handovers in our two bigger hospitals, so the Royal and the PA, they do trauma handovers in entirely different ways. The Royal do it sort of from the end of the bed. You call it out to everybody, and everybody is supposed to stay hands off until that happens. But I think by our nature, emergency providers are a little bit impatient and a little bit, we want to get on and do it now. So if your handover is going too long, nurses and doctors will just start to do stuff, and then you lose the room. And then the trauma team leader gets distracted by watching what his or her team are doing, and then they stop listening to you, and then the whole thing falls over. So I think brevity is one of the key things, but it's also got to be comprehensive, and those two things are obviously competing. The PA is slightly different in that you hand over just to the team leader at the end of the room, and that person gives you gives you full attention while you give your handover, and then they summarize for the team. Whichever hospital I'm going to, it doesn't really matter. I do things the same way. And I know if people who've been in the back of the truck with me would probably have recognized this. What I will do is do a recap about 5 minutes before we get to the hospital. And there's two reasons behind that. Number one is it's the same as any other recap, just making sure that we've got everything, we've done everything, we've given all our interventions, we've completed everything that we wanted to complete. And the second thing is that it is a rehearsal of my handover. I think if you don't rehearse your handover, particularly when you haven't done many handovers, if you don't rehearse it and rehearse it out loud, then it's just not going to go well. Because essentially, it's a performance. It's you're giving a 30 or 60 second performance and you get one shot and then you're off the stage. So rehearse is my single word of advice about handovers would be rehearse.
That's a really great piece of advice and something that students utilize a lot and have been taught to do a lot, which is get out a piece of that ECG paper and write down your handover in your structured approach. And it's something that I've been told that even graduates have been ridiculed a little bit for doing, that they should just know it from the top of their head. But I also think that if you've got notes, it's, you're less likely to miss things. Communication is something you just brought up as a really important topic, and something that we could obviously chat about all day. But recently in the episode that released, I think it was episode 13 with Rory Jackson, he mentioned the importance of recapping or being able to communicate your plan out loud, not just so that the patient understands what's happening, but so your team are aware. What are some of your just key takeaways for communication for students to be able to utilize?
I think know your message at the start. You need to communicate with yourself before you can communicate with anybody else. And if you've recognized that you're in that state of fluster and you're just talking, almost thinking out loud, then people just aren't going to listen. So you've got to have a high degree of emotional intelligence, and you'll see that. You'll see when people are ready to listen to you, but you've got to be able to recognize and accept those sort of social cues to do that. So, for example, if I'm about to stick a laryngoscope in somebody's mouth, just to use that as an example, then I'm totally focused on that, and you can say whatever you want to me. I'm just not going to hear you. Whereas, 15 seconds later, like I mentioned a little while ago, in that moment when the tube is being tied, I've got full attention to give to whatever you want. So if you wait until that sort of gap in proceedings to say what you want to say, you're much more likely to have the reception that you need to get your message across. So I think that the timing of your message and the clarity of your message are really important. Now, obviously, if there's something dangerous happening, like if I'm about to intubate somebody and you suddenly recognize that the oxygen's come off the bag valve mask, then do one of two things: either reconnect it and have the problem fixed, or else tell me that it's a problem because it's a critical problem at this juncture. But otherwise, if you want to tell me that the patient's wife has arrived, then I just don't need to know that. I need to know that, but not at that point in time. So I think it's having the emotional intelligence to know when to give your message and how your message fits in the priority of everything else that's going on at this point in time.
Those are some great pieces of or takeaways that we can utilize, and obviously communicating when need be. What behaviors or attitudes that you've seen in students characterize the best that you've seen out on road?
I think respectful enthusiasm would be how I would put it. So you don't want does the Energizer Bunny, was the Energizer Bunny a thing in Australia?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, cool. So you don't want somebody who's like an Energizer Bunny who is sort of super excited and jumping around and being a distraction. But you also don't want somebody who's hanging around the corner of the ambulance with their hands in their pockets, totally disengaged. So it's almost like baby bear's porridge. You want the perfect person. But I'm always impressed by people who will do stuff like climb into the cab facing backwards where they can look at what's going on and hear what's going on and ask an intelligent question at the right point in time without interfering with the patient care that's going on. So that sort of enthusiasm to learn, but without sort of being in the way, which is, you know, that varies from time to time with what's going on. But the other thing that annoys me sometimes is people asking questions that they already know the answers to. Now, you know, asking a question to verify something you think is completely fine, but it's very obvious to experienced providers if you're just asking a question to make yourself look intelligent or clever. You just get seen through very, very quickly. So I think somebody who's willing to help out and get involved, but also learn about every aspect of the job, this is how we take motorcycle boots off, for example. That's as important a skill to learn as how we go about doing an RSI. Because often those two things are happening simultaneously. And these are all things that you need to know at some point in time.
Awesome. Well, those are some great points.
Just a question that someone sent in, which I guess is a bit of an interesting one, actually. If you were in a rural area or, I guess, not on the job, what are some ways to be, resourceful or make common equipment out of, I guess, everyday household items? Someone's put here, e.g. Glad wrap and tape for a chest seal.
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting question. My advice would be don't. if you look at chest seals, for example, and if you go back in the last 20 or 30 years and look at the number of products that have come out to seal a sucking chest wound, I can sort of think of about a dozen like brand names just off the top of my head, some of which I've used, some of which I haven't. Some of them have been successful and have sort of stayed in the market, and many of them haven't. I think trying to MacGyver stuff, on the fly, if you like, runs the risk of you trying to overcomplicate things and try to find a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. You know, if you want to seal a sucking chest wound, you know, what is wrong with putting your hand over it? Sure, you get your hand tied up, but if you get some Glad wrap, are you sure that none of that Glad wrap is going to stay in the wound afterwards? How are you going to secure that Glad wrap? Are you going to get cognitively distracted by preparing this homemade device and securing this homemade device, and then miss something else that's going on with the patient because you've been so task focused on doing all of this? I think the simpler the better. The more complicated any machine is, the more likely it is to break down. And the more moving parts, like helicopters being a really good example, the more moving parts you have, the more likely it is that something's going to fall off it. So if you just keep things as simple as you can, you know, everything boils down to that, you know, that sort of basics that we mentioned earlier, about, you know, the ABC approach to everything. Just do the simplest thing that's going to work and don't overcomplicate it.
Awesome. That's a great piece of advice. And that's interesting because, it was one of the things that did get sent through. And the person that we were speaking to about that said that that's something that their paramedics mentioned on a placement to do. So it's always great to get that feedback from someone like you. And, really interesting. So we had some ones around approach to trauma regarding like abdominal trauma, crush injuries, TBIs, but I think we obviously don't have enough time to go over all of those today.
Can I just mention crush injury?
Yeah.
And my four words of advice on crush injury are don't worry about it. Because it's not in our urban practice in Brisbane, in Queensland, in Australia, it's not a thing. Okay, it is a thing in building collapses, in earthquakes, in disaster. But, you know, this comes up very frequently for us on road, and it comes up quite frequently in Harrow audit as well. But, you know, somebody who's been in a road traffic collision who requires extrication, and are they suffering from crush syndrome? Should we preload them with, you know, we get this question all the time, should we give bicarb before we get them out? No is the answer. I'll explain why, but no is the answer. Just don't do it. The crush syndrome is a thing. It's a function of how much tissue was crushed for how long. So where you see it is in people who are crushed in buildings, where, you know, their entire lower limbs are crushed for hours upon hours upon hours. We don't often see that. And if you think about this logically, you think about what happens in operating theatres, for example. So I was involved in a research study in Ireland back in 2006, 2007, something like that, where we took a whole lot of hemodynamic and biochemical measurements from patients who were undergoing orthopedic surgery with tourniquets, so high up leg tourniquets, with tourniquet times of 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, and found that there was essentially no change. So it was like a non-statistically significant change in potassium of, I think from memory, is like 0.2 millimoles per liter. So this is not a thing in our practice. It becomes a thing after extrication if you get signs of hyperkalemia on your ECG. Then yeah, absolutely, I would treat it at that point in time. But often what happens is you extricate the person and they become hypotensive. But that's multifactorial and not necessarily Crush syndrome. It's a function of how much blood is circulating, what size the container is. Because if you imagine both of your legs are crushed, the size of the circulating container is much reduced if it's just your body from your pelvis up, essentially. And now if you're perfusing those legs again, the container is bigger. You've got the same amount of fluid, same pump, so the pressure is going to drop. So it's a function of that, as opposed to, you know, the famous toxins that are suddenly getting washed out. So certainly giving a fluid load just before you extricate them is a reasonable idea, but I would only treat with bicarb if you get demonstrated ECG evidence of hyperkalemia.
That's really interesting. I learned something new. That's awesome. Well, we don't want to keep you for too long. And obviously, we've gone through the approach to trauma today rather than specific like components of trauma and specific injuries other than just then with crush injury. So to finalize, just want to ask you one question to get you thinking a little bit, is what job has taught you the most and why?
I distinctly remember a job that was in a nightclub. So responded as part of a 2-person ambulance crew, and we had a CCP type responder with us as well, who came in a different vehicle. So 3 of us on scene. It was in a nightclub. A guy had jumped or fallen from a balcony, landed on the dance floor, was unresponsive. Music still going, lights still flashing, it was dark, drunk people all pushing around. So really challenging sort of environment to work in. The nightclub refused to do anything about it. And I think in retrospect, it probably would have caused as much trouble to try and stop all these people from partying. There's like 700 people in this room as it would have been to let them continue. So at some point in the process of extricating this gentleman from the ground to the back of the truck, he stopped breathing. And once we got him in the back of the truck, we recognized that he'd stopped breathing and we started ventilating him. But I don't know at what point he stopped breathing. Now, his sats didn't drop dramatically. They were like 99% in there on the floor, and there were 92% when we started ventilating, and they came back up very quickly. But he had a desaturation. And when I reflected back on this afterwards, I couldn't tell you at what point he stopped breathing. So he had been on and on a breather, so he had a big oxygen reservoir, which certainly helped him to not desaturate hugely. But it got me thinking about, you know, my ability to multitask in my head about what was going on, to prioritize in terms of what was going on, basically came to zero. Because as soon as we got him off the floor, so we used a scoop to get him onto the ambulance stretcher, then we wheeled him out. But at some point during that process, he stopped breathing and I didn't notice. So that really drove home for me the importance of one person being responsible for monitoring the patient at all times. And I think it kind of comes back to, you know, this is your patient, you must examine them, you're responsible for them. All 3 of us were there responsible for this patient. And due to many, many factors, the environment and the difficulty in communication being only part of it, none of us monitored that patient appropriately while we wheeled him out of the truck. And once we got him on board, we recognized what was going on and we reversed it and we fixed it. So, you know, it was all good in the end. But if that extrication process had taken 1, 2, 3, 4 minutes longer, then this patient may well have had a worse outcome simply based on the fact that none of us recognized that he stopped breathing. So I learned a lot from that.
I think it's really refreshing to see someone at your level and stature be so honest about mistakes and how you learned from them. I think that, you know, the mistakes that we make in practice, if we can share them and how we overcame them with those around us, it really helps us when it comes to learning as well, so that we don't make them as well. So thanks for that.
Definitely. That seems like a very lesson learned sort of case. It's really amazing. And thank you for sharing that. We will probably cap it off there because, you know, we've picked your brain quite a bit today. So I do really appreciate you coming on and taking the time out of your day to chat with us and give us some advice on how to approach trauma. And I'm sure that in the future we might chat again about specific injuries regarding trauma. So that'll be potentially, if you're keen to do that, we could do that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.